We are starting our new year here in our learning. The date is August the 23rd, and we are beginning Parashas Miketz on page 222. Our last class before we broke for the summer involved discussing how this first pasuk that says Vayhi Miketz Shnasayim Yamim Ufaroch Olei Minei Omed Al Yor, that it was at the end of 2 years and Paro is dreaming and behold he is standing on the river, how it is all in the present tense. And we talked about how really Yosef was supposed to get out of jail 2 years earlier, but because he asked the wine steward for help, as a result he was punished on his level. That was doing too much. He should have not relied on the Sar HaMashkim. And because he did, he was condemned to be in jail for an additional 2 years. But the scene had already been set for him to get out. Everything was in place. And so all the factors that needed to be there for him to get out in Egypt were already set up. So Hashem just had the scene repeat itself. And Paro had his dream over and over and over again for 2 years straight. But when he woke up in the morning, he did not even remember that he had dreamt. And therefore nothing happened. And now 2 years later, he finally dreams, and as we will see when he wakes up, he will remember that he dreamed, and therefore this will now have Yosef get out of jail. So that's where we're up to. So again, Vayhi Miketz Shnasayim Yamim was at the end of 2 years from when Yosef asked the Sar HaMashkin for help. Ufaro Cholem Paro is dreaming, Vinei Omed Al HaYor, and behold he is standing on the Yor. Rashi points out the word Yor, which they translate as river. What the typical word for Yeor, excuse me, the typical word for river is, anybody know? Nahar. Nun Heresh. Nahar is the typical word for river. Yeor actually means that which irrigates. That which waters, that which irrigates. That's what Yeor actually means. Now, of course, a river irrigates if you want it to, but it doesn't have to. You could have rivers that flow and you don't use it to water crops. But because it doesn't rain in Egypt, and the
Nile,
right, the Nile, the only way that they were able to irrigate their crops was through the Nile. It was impossible to do it through rain because it didn't rain. And therefore, everybody dug irrigation ditches from the Nile to their fields. And that was the typical way things were done. And so, therefore, the Nile is called the Yor, that which irrigates. So that's why the Nile is called Yor. Rashi says no other river is called Yor except for the Nile. V'hinei min ha'Yor, behold from the river, olos sheva paros, seven cows are coming up, yefos mareh ubrios basar, which are good of appearance and healthy of flesh, vatirena ba'ahu, and they grazed on the swamp. How do they translate ba'ahu? The marshland. Behold, seven other cows are coming up after them from the river. Ra'os mareh, not nice appearance. Vidakos basar, and gaunt of flesh. Vata'amodna etho ha'paros asfas hayar, and they stood next to the cows on the river bank. And of course, the cow gaunt is not good. Vatochalna ha'paros, ra'os hamareh vidakos ha'basar. And the cows that were not of nice appearance and that were gaunt of flesh consumed Eis Sheva HaParos Yefos HaMareva HaBrios, the seven cows that were of good appearance and that were healthy, Vayikat Paro. And Paro woke up. So there's the first dream. Paro dreams about the seven cows that were healthy, seven gaunt, unhealthy cows. The seven gaunt, unhealthy cows consume the healthy cows, and then Paro wakes up. That's first dream. Vayishan, and he slept. He went back to sleep. Vayachalom shenis, and he dreamed the second dream. Vihine sheva shibolim, and behold, there are seven sheaves, seven ears they translate it as. Olos bekane echad brios vitavos, that are coming up in one stalk, that are healthy and good. I'm looking at they say 7 ears of grain, single stalk. Okay. V'hinei sheva shibalim, and behold seven ears, dakos, that are scrawny, thin, ushtufos kadim, and that had been blighted by the east wind, tzomchos acharehem, that are sprouting after them, vativlana hashibolim hadakos, and the gaunt, the skinny sheaves consumed, swallowed, eis sheva hashibolim habrios vahamaleos, the seven sheaves that were healthy and full, vayikatz paro, and paro woke up, vihine chalom, and behold, a dream. That's the two dreams.
Being it's mentioned as a chalom, singular, then I'm thinking it's really one dream.
Okay, it sounds like it's one dream. Mm-hmm. Let's read one more pasuk, and then we'll talk about this. Vayhi baboker, it was in the morning, vatipa'em rucho, and his spirit, the word vatipa'em comes from the word pa'am, or pa'amon means a bell. His spirit rung. How do they translate it here? His spirit was agitated. Vayishlach, and he sent, vayikos kol chartumei Mitzrayim es kol chachameha, and he called to all the sorcerers of Mitzrayim and to all of its wise men. Vayisaper paro lahem es chalomo, and paro told over his story, his dream to them. Ve'ein poser osam lefaro, and none of them translated them to Paro. None of them interpreted them to Paro. Okay. Now you know what's going to happen next, which is that the Sar Hamashkim is going to mention about Yosef. But let's hold it right here and let's talk about these first eight verses. So let's tell over in our own words what happened. Paro is sleeping and he's dreaming. And he's dreaming about seven cows that are healthy and good. And then he dreams about seven unhealthy cows. And the unhealthy cows consume the healthy cows. And Paro wakes up. Now, interestingly, at the end of Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, it does not say, Vayikatz Paro, and Paro woke up, Vihine Chalom, and behold a dream. Now, we know he dreamt. It says, in the first Pasuk, it says, Ufaro Cholein, Paro was dreaming. But it does not say, Paro woke up and behold a dream, as it says at the end of the second dream.
It says they're ugly. That doesn't actually make them unhealthy.
It says that they were
ugly appearance.
Right, they were ugly appearance and gaunt.
Yeah.
It's two different things.
Oh.
Right, you're right. You're right. We're going to discuss those two descriptions. Yeah. Then it says Paro went to sleep, and he dreamed a second time, by a halom shenis, verse 5, pasuk hey. Vayishani went to sleep by a halom shenis. He dreamt a second dream, and behold, there are seven sheaves that are nice and good, and seven that are unhealthy, and the ones that are unhealthy consume the ones that are healthy. And Paro wakes up at the end of Pasuk Zion, verse 7, Vayikatz Paro, Vihine Chalom, and behold a dream. Now, was it one dream, or was it two dreams? The Torah says two. The Torah says he dreamt a second dream. Yet when he wakes up, it says, and Paro woke up, and behold a dream. Was it one or two?
He was so fortunate, because sometimes I'm dreaming a dream and then I wake up and I want to go back to sleep and finish it, and I never can.
Okay. Okay. Well, you're bringing up a good point. How was he able to go back to sleep? He woke up from the first dream. Apparently, the first dream didn't really bother him. Right? He woke up, he went back to sleep.
Yeah, but he sent his messengers to interpret those.
That's after the second dream. But after the first dream, it says he woke up, and then Pasuk Hey, verse 5, Vayishan, he went to sleep. Now, if I wake up in the middle of the night with a dream that troubles me, I'm not going back to sleep so quick in a hurry, right? It's hard to fall back asleep if you wake up with a troubling dream. We must therefore assume that after the first dream, Paro wasn't troubled. The first dream didn't bother him. He dreamt about seven cows, another seven cows, one swallows the other. All right, he woke up, he went back to sleep. It didn't bother him. He did wake up, and maybe that does indicate a little bit of troubling, because it did wake him up, but then he went back to sleep. Then he has the second dream. And now he wakes up, and behold, a dream. So as Mrs. Starkman said, Rashi explains that the words, v'hine chalom, behold, a dream, are coming to teach us that now Paro knew he needed an interpretation. See, after the first dream, he was willing to dismiss it. So he woke up with a dream. Everybody dreams. Dreams, as we have spoken about in the past, we've talked about dreams and which types of dreams are significant and which types of dreams are meaningless. And the vast majority of dreams are meaningless. It's very rare that a dream actually means something, but sometimes it does. After the first dream, Paro was willing to dismiss it as being meaningless. It didn't bother him. But once he had the second dream, now he knew that it was not just random thoughts, and in fact, they were significant. And so Paro now wakes up, and behold, a dream. There were two dreams, yes, but the two dreams weren't really two dreams, they were really one dream, and they were serious. And it's one thought. Seven healthy, seven unhealthy, the unhealthy consume the healthy. That's a dream that needs interpretation. Now Paro is worried. It says in Pasuk Ches, verse 8, it was in the morning about Tipa Emrucho, his spirit was agitated. Rashi points out that we have a very similar language with Nebuchadnezzar. In Sefer Daniel, in the book of Daniel, towards the beginning of the book, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And in this dream, Nebuchadnezzar dreams all kinds of things. And it says he woke up in the morning, Vatispa emrucho, and his spirit was agitated. But it says it slightly differently than it says it here. Instead of spelling it, if you look in the verse, in Pasuk Ches, verse 8, it says, Vahiva boker vatipa emrucho, vav tuf pei ayin mem. With Nebuchadnezzar, there are two tufs. Vatispa emrucho.
Hispael.
So, that is, Rashi tells us, because Nebuchadnezzar was doubly agitated. Paro was agitated. Nebuchadnezzar was doubly agitated. Why? Because Nebuchadnezzar not only didn't know the interpretation of his dream, he couldn't remember what he dreamt. He knew that he had dreamt something that was troubling, but he couldn't remember the dream. And all the more so, he couldn't interpret it. So, Vatispa'em, the double agitation of Nebuchadnezzar, indicates that he was so agitated because he couldn't even remember the dream. Paro did remember the dream. He remembered everything he dreamt, but he was still agitated because he didn't have an interpretation. So all Paro needed was an interpretation. Over there, in Sefer Daniel, in the book of Daniel, Daniel makes his mark over there because not only is he able to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he's able to tell him what he dreamt. And that shocks Nebuchadnezzar, that he's able to first tell him what it is that he dreamt and what the interpretation is. Here, Yosef is not needed to tell Paro what he dreamt, but, of course, the interpretation is the important thing.
It's strange here to see Rashi's interpretation saying there were interpreters galore.
Mm-hmm.
Using the word galore in the book.
Yeah.
Rabbi,
yeah.
What is it that's doubled in the Hebrew?
The double tuf. Here it's only singular. Vatipa'em. In Sefer Daniel, it's Vatispa'em. There's another tuf after the first one. Suf.
Okay.
Now, so why is it that the first dream doesn't trouble Paro and the second dream does? Let's think about this a little bit. Now, the obvious answer is because it's a recurring dream. Anytime you have a recurring dream, then it bothers you. Like, why did I dream the thing twice? Now, let's think about that for a minute. Why does a recurring dream bother us? If I have a dream, and I'm willing to dismiss it as being nothing, why is it that if I have the same dream again, now it bothers me?
It wakes you up.
You think it's trying to tell you something. Well, maybe the same reason why I had the first dream, I had the second dream. That's, when I dismissed it the first time, what did I attribute it to? I have a dream that a dog follows me home. Okay? All right, that's a pretty random dream. I have a dream. Now, I wake up, big deal. So a dog followed me home. Okay, fine. So then I go to sleep and I have the same dream again. Now it bothers me. Why did I dismiss it the first time?
You think it was important. You reinforced it. You didn't think it was important.
I didn't think it was important. I dismissed it. Now, why did I dream about a dog following me home?
Anything. It happened in the day.
Anything. Who knows? I saw a dog today.
Right.
You know, maybe
had
I was...
Ice cream before you went to
huh?
Had ice cream.
Had ice cream before I went to sleep. Right? Right? Who knows? So I say, who knows? But if I have it a second time, so now I'm already wondering, now it seems like there is method to the madness. Where a dream, I say it's random. It's just random mishmash thoughts, which mean nothing. But if I have it a second time, it seems like there's a method to my dreaming. Now, where's the method coming from? I imagine it's coming from a source greater than myself. It's coming from upstairs somewhere. Otherwise, why would I have the same thing twice? If it's all random, so random doesn't happen twice in a row. That's very strange. So if it happens twice in a row, it seems like there's some method to it and there's some message being sent down to me.
So are we supposed to interpret that, you know, when we have recurring similar dreams?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. But that is why it bothers us more when we have it again. It is logical that it should bother us more when we have it again. Does Paro have the same dream twice?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't. It's not the same dream twice.
The theme is the same. But
it's the same theme, but it's a different dream. So why should that bother Paro? So it's the same theme. So if I go to sleep and a dog follows me home, and then I go to sleep and a cat follows me to the co-op. Now, I don't know. Am I going to start thinking there's a method to that?
No, but...
Maybe. You know, it's sort of similar.
But there's something. I had recently a dog came out as I'm walking the shore. So my next week when I was ready to walk, you know, do I want to take a ball with me or to throw them to run? Or a stick or spray? So there's something to think about with it when it happens twice. It's different, but there's something in it.
It's a similar theme.
But yeah. It's the eating, the consuming by the inferior to the superior, that's pretty focused.
Okay. So there seems to be something incongruous here. It doesn't make sense. It's not logical for the scrawny to consume the healthy. That doesn't make sense. It's illogical. And the same theme recurs. But I want to let's focus on something a little more sharply over here. There's something else in the second dream which really would tip off the dreamer that this theme is significant. See, in the first dream, when the scrawny cows consume the healthy cows, so it's unusual, it's strange. Is it impossible? Can a cow consume a cow? Theoretically, it could eat, right? It's true, cows don't eat meat, but... Okay. But it is a consumer. Do sheaves of wheat consume anything?
No.
See, the second dream is more illogical than the first. The first dream is illogical, but at least it's within the realm of possibility. A cow can consume a cow. It's within, I don't mean it's within the realm that you're going to see it, but it's something which, well, you know, a cow chews, and, you know, is it? But that, where is the sheaves of wheat's mouth? What part of it consumed the other one? We don't even know when we read the pasuk. We don't know. Like, what consumed what? Did it open up? Did he see the sheep wheat open and chomp down on the other one? Or did he just see one kind of merge into the other one? What did he see happen? We don't know. Just from reading this, you don't know. But I imagine that whatever it is that he saw in the second dream, it was more wild than the first one. And so, therefore, more wild than the first one, yet the same theme, now we're seeing something significant over here. There's something going on which Paro is very worried about.
Is it possible he had never had weird dreams before? And that's where he was so agitated?
It is possible, but then the first dream should have made him agitated, and it didn't. So it seems like having a weird dream is not so out of the ordinary. But having it twice or having the same theme twice, and it becomes more extraordinary, but the same theme, that tips Paro off. That makes Paro nervous. And now he needs an interpretation. Now we know what the interpretation is going to be. We are aware the interpretation is going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. We are aware of that. We are also aware Yosef is going to tell Paro that the reason why Hashem showed him the dream twice is to tell him that this is going to happen now. This is not going to happen a year from now. It's going to happen right away. It's about to happen. This is right on the doorstep. There are other factors that Yosef is going to tell Paro which are evident in the dream. Let's look at the dreams again a little more carefully and see how Yosef is going to pick apart these dreams. Number one, looking first at Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Excuse me, let's start with Pasuk Beis, verse 2. It says that the seven cows were Yefos Mar'eh, they looked good, Uvrios Basar, and were healthy of flesh. So Rashi tells us, what does it mean they looked good? In times of plenty, people look at each other with a good eye. People tend to look at each other graciously when things are good. When there's a lot of food to eat, and there's a lot of money, and people are able to spend it, people tend to look at each other more generously, more graciously. There's more of a benevolent eye that people have towards each other. Whereas, God forbid, in times of famine, times of poverty, then people look at each other with a more stringent look, a more stingy look. This is a very, very important lesson to bear in mind. It will contrast it to Pasuk Gimel, to verse 3, where it says that the scrawny cows were ra'os mar'eh. They were bad of sight, which means people look at each other badly when there is some sort of lack of funds. This is a very, very important point to bear in mind. It is crucial to know, and I'm not saying this in order to promote fear, but we have to understand the way the world works. We look back at Europe, pre-World War II Europe, and we see rampant anti-Semitism. Before Nazi Germany, there was anti-Semitism. In Poland, in Russia, there was a hotbed of anti-Semitism. We know that, thank God, in the society we live in, anti-Semitism is blatant. It's not overt. Thank God we live pretty good lives. It's important to bear in mind that the poverty of pre-war Eastern Europe contrasted to the affluence of post-World War II Western world is a significant factor in this. It's important to know that when there's poverty, and in Eastern Europe, pre-war Eastern Europe, was terrible, terrible poverty. The Jews for sure were impoverished, but so were the non-Jews. It was a very difficult life. In that sort of setting, anti-Semitism is going to naturally be more overt, because people are not as happy. People are not as willing to be generous, to overlook things. People are more likely to stand on principle when things are hard. People just don't take things nicely and easily. And therefore, if there is any amount of hatred, it's going to boil up very quickly. Whereas, when things are plentiful, then even if there is some hatred beneath the surface, it's not necessarily going to boil up so fast, because people are generally more easygoing when there is more. That's a very important factor to remember. And so the affluence that we have been blessed with, it's not only important for us because this way we are able to live well, which is good, and we're able to survive, and we're able to thrive and grow, and we're able to serve Hashem, but it also serves to help protect us from what otherwise could be a very difficult anti-Semitic situation. Because even those who would be our enemies, but things are more calm when there is plenty. Yeah?
Why was there so much poverty in people?
I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer. You know, different times in the world and different things. You know, we've just gone through an economic downturn. Whether it will right itself and things will go back to the way they were before, or whether we have entered a new phase, we don't know. We don't know. Could be it's a new phase in the way that Hashem runs the world. Could be. Bear in mind that what we're going through now is nothing like pre-war Europe. You know, people, thank God, are not starving. It's not like that.
Was it because of World War I? They never recuperated from World War I. They couldn't have factories. There were a whole lot of things that were now forbidden to Europe. She was always scapegoated.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in economic times that are difficult.
Yeah.
She was always at the one to blame.
Yeah. Okay, now.
Jealousy
only is true if we have and they don't.
It boils up when
it gets bad. Yeah, yeah. In Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, it says there were 7 other cows that were not nice of appearance, and they were gaunt, and they stood next to the other ones. So Paro saw the contrast. They stood next to them. Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, they consumed them. The 7 gaunt cows consumed the 7 cows that were healthy, and Paro woke up. So what does consuming teach us? You know, it could have been that the 7 gaunt cows came out of the river, and the 7 healthy cows went back into the river. That's what could have happened. But instead, one consumed the other. So what does that teach us, that one consumed the other?
It overtook it.
Rashi tells us that the consuming teaches us that all of the joy of the times of plenty will be forgotten completely in a time of famine. We human beings do this all the time. We are very quick to remember all of the terrible times that we've had and all the pains that we've had. But we're very quick to forget all of the good things that we had in the past, if we don't have them now. Sometimes we can remember to thank Hashem for the good things that we have, which is a good midah. But when the good things aren't there, it's very difficult to remember them when we're in pain. And here, that's what's being said over here, that the fact that the one consumed the other is to show that that they would forget all about the 7 good years. They were in the past. They're finished. They're gone. And no one's going to remember them when everybody's running around looking for food. Okay. What is the significance that the cows came up out of the river?
Well, they worship the river. The river now is considered like a god to them.
Okay.
It has some importance to it.
Okay.
That's their livelihood. They depend on that river.
But also, it was a god.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Nile River is the source of life for Egypt. So therefore, things that come up out of the river show something very important is going on. It's the livelihood. The river is going to produce great, plentiful cows for 7 years, and then the river is going to produce famine for 7 years. It all comes from the river. The Nile is the source of all that is of all life in Egypt. Yeah.
It's strange that if it never rained in Egypt, that the river would continue to sustain Egypt? I mean, how did it?
It rains upstream. It rains upstream, which is farther south. The Nile flows from south to north, and it rains further south.
It rains further south and flows
north. It flows north.
That's also.
No. It's not unusual for a river to flow north. On a map, it looks funny because it's up, but it's not unusual. You know, rivers do flow in any direction. So it rains further up, upstream, and then it flows down. But it doesn't rain in Egypt. Paro calls the sorcerers of Mitzrayim and its wise men, and he tells them over what happened. Now look carefully in Pasuk Ches, verse 8, ends off, Ve'ein poser osam lefaro, there was no one who interpreted them to Paro. That word lefaro, to Paro, seems to be extra. It could have said, Ve'ein poser osam, and no one interpreted the dream. Why does it say no one interpreted the dream to Paro?
They didn't want to tell him bad news.
So it means you're saying they knew, but they didn't tell him.
They knew. I'm guessing that they knew something, but didn't want to turn it over to him.
Okay. Okay. Then it could have said, okay. Okay.
But none would tell Paro.
What's that?
It could have said, but none would tell.
None would tell Paro?
Then for sure would know they knew.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
The emperor said Osam. To what does Osam refer?
Them, the dreams.
But it was only one dream.
Good. If the two dreams are one, it's two that are one. You're right. They're two, but they're considered one.
Maybe he didn't want to believe the dreams.
Well, the Chazal tell us, and Rashi says, Vein poser osam lefaro, they did interpret them, but they didn't interpret them to Paro. Now, Mrs. Wittenberg was suggesting they didn't tell him. The way Rashi explains it is they did tell him, but they didn't settle his mind. When a person dreams and you attempt to interpret the dream for them, sometimes the interpretation will settle them, sometimes they won't. They won't settle the person if it doesn't ring with the truth. They told Paro interpretations, but the interpretations that they told Paro did not ring with the truth. They did not settle his mind. He was still nervous about it. When Yosef said over his interpretation, Paro immediately said, "Oh, that makes sense. That fits." But what they told him didn't fit. What did they tell him that didn't fit? So Chazal tell us, or sages say, what did they tell him? They told him, you will bear seven daughters, you will bury seven daughters. That's what they told him. They told him the interpretation of the dream is, you will have seven daughters, you will bury seven daughters. That was what they told Paro. And that did not sit well with Paro. It's not that he didn't like the interpretation, but it didn't fit. It didn't help him. He was still bothered.
There's a corn that he used to pick up.
Okay. Okay, let's digress for a moment, just because you reminded me of something. Linda just reminded me of something. Ears of corn. What does the word corn mean? You know that they didn't have what we call corn in Egypt.
That's right.
Corn.
And maize. Isn't it?
Well, maize, which is corn, did not exist in Egypt.
It's some kind of
issue. In those days. No. But if you look in old translations of the Chumash, you will find that it says over here, ears of corn. So people read this and they think it means corn. So this is a simple mistake. The word corn means grain. It's an Old English word for grain. That's what it means. What we call corn is actually maize, which we use the word corn to mean that the stuff that you have to shuck and has little yellow thingies. But the word corn, that when they use it as in an English translation, in Chumash, doesn't mean that. It means grain. Wheat, barley, that's what it means. That's what the word corn means. Yeah. If you look in a dictionary of the word corn, you'll see that an old meaning of the word corn is grain.
So still, even if it's grain, the daughters...
Yeah. So they told him, you'll have seven daughters and you'll bury seven daughters. Now, why did they say that? They weren't fools. They were wise men. They weren't fools. Why do they say seven? You'll bear seven daughters and you'll bury seven daughters? Why daughters? Why not sons?
Cow.
I know. Okay. Female. Maybe. Maybe.
Well, that would be such a dead end thing. I mean, you couldn't do anything about it.
Right. True. True. That's their negative. Their. What's the point of telling him? What's the point of telling him? But before we get to that, which is an excellent observation, before we get to that, why did they say seven daughters instead of seven sons, instead of seven jewels? You'll find seven jewels and you'll lose seven jewels.
Must be cows get milk. Okay. Is it a door for the future and Kleistos and Mitzrayim?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it has to do with Kleistos and Mitzrayim. But let's deal with the facts here that we have in front of us. So, you're suggesting milk, that they give milk. Let's think about the Nile and giving off its bounty, its fruitfulness, its produce. So, you're not going to say sons, you're going to say daughters. If he would have dreamt something about conquest, war, some kind of building, then, like seven, if he would have dreamt seven tall buildings and seven crumbling buildings, maybe they would have said, you're going to have seven sons. And you're going to bury seven sons. But when you talk about produce, you talk about grain, you're talking about fruitfulness, that indicates female, not male. It indicates growth in population. You, Paro, are going to have seven daughters, but then, with the seven scrawny ones, you'll bury seven daughters. Not necessarily the same ones. They didn't tell him, you will have seven daughters and they will die. All they said is, you see from the dreams, you're going to bear seven daughters and you're also going to bury seven daughters. That's what they told him. So it didn't sit well with Paro. And why didn't it sit well with Paro? Seems like a pretty possible, it's a plausible explanation. I mean, if you know, we know in hindsight what the true explanation is. But they didn't know in hindsight. So why is that? Why does that not seem plausible to Paro?
He's the king and all-powerful, and if he can't do anything about it, that's not acceptable.
Okay, what's the point in telling me this? Whatever power is making Paro know the future, it's Hashem, if Paro thinks it's some kind of deity, whatever it is, but whatever power is tipping Paro off to the future, why? Why tell Paro? This is a crucial point, because we know that later when Yosef interprets Paro's dreams, Yosef is going to take liberty, which is also a little bit of a risk. Yosef, when he interprets Paro's dreams, he's going to tell him what the dreams mean, and then what's he going
to do?
He's going to tell him what to do about it. Uh-huh. Yosef, who asked you? Who asked you? I didn't ask you to advise me about what to do in the future. I asked you, what does the dream mean? But Yosef, you'll see, when he advises Paro, Paro's going to be very taken with Yosef, not only about the interpretations, but about Yosef's advice. But where does Yosef get the guts to offer an advice about what to do about the dreams?
Because it's in the dream.
But not with
the connection with Hashem. He even says about the dream, I didn't interpret it.
But the dreams don't tell you what to do about it. He's going to advise Paro to save food for many years, etc. Doesn't say that in the dream. All the dreams tell you is what's going to happen. 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. Doesn't tell you what to do about it. Yosef is going to tell him 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And then Yosef is going to tell him, and you know what Paro should do about that? You should get officers and set them up and collect the food and put it away. Yosef, who are you? I asked you to enter, you know. If you ever get a phone call, you've got a deaf person who's calling, and they have the TDY, right?
Yeah.
The deaf person types in what they want to say, and then the person tells you over what the deaf person is saying, but that person is not allowed to do anything but tell you what the deaf person is writing, and then write to the deaf person what you're saying. That's it. They're not allowed to do anything else. That's their job. Their job is to convey the message. They're not allowed to say anything else. A king calls Yosef, says, interpret my dream. Yosef does it. And then he goes on to offer advice. Who is he?
Well, he's in prison, so maybe he wants to impress the guy.
Okay, that's true. Could be trying to impress, but it's more than that. The reason why Paro can't deal with the interpretations that he's being given is because they're meaningless, because they don't do anything. So what? So I'm going to have 7 daughters, I'm going to bury 7 daughters. Why am I being told that? I'll find out when it happens. What's the point of telling me now? Yosef is empowering Paro. Yosef tells Paro what the dreams are all about, and then tells him, and you know what? This is what you should do about it. There, Paro says, Yosef's got a head on his shoulders. Yosef knows what he's talking about. Yosef knows what the dreams mean and what to do about it. That's why it rings with the truth. Now I understand why I was told. I was told the dreams in order to do something about it. And we're going to see, and we'll talk about this more in depth later, that it's not just that Yosef's advice to Paro means that the country of Mitzrayim will be saved from certain starvation, certain death by starvation, which is what would have happened had they not saved up the food, because there wouldn't have been enough food to go around. People would have starved to death. It would have been devastating to the country. So not only does Yosef's plan save Egypt from starvation, but it catapults Egypt to being the economic and by extension military power of the world. Because all the other countries surrounding Egypt didn't have food, and where were they going to get food from? The only country that had, which is Egypt. All of a sudden, there's only one country in the world that has oil, and everybody's going to buy from that country. All of a sudden, Saudi Arabia, which is a desert, becomes a wealthy, incredibly wealthy country. How does that happen? Because all of a sudden it has a commodity that nobody else has, almost overnight. Yosef made Mitzrayim have a commodity that everybody needed and nobody had, except Mitzrayim. Paro sees the wisdom of Yosef right away. That Yosef is not only going to save us from certain death, he's going to catapult us into the most powerful nation in the world. And that's what happens. So the dreams, therefore, are extremely significant. It's important that the king knows these dreams, because the king can act upon them, and they are going to totally transform the international life of Mitzrayim. And that's why Yosef's interpretations sit very well with Paro. Okay, no questions. Good.
Yeah,
oh, you do? Okay, go ahead.
Is this the era where Egypt is the most powerful in its existence?
They're going to become very, very powerful.
I mean, is this because, you know, we read in history books that Egypt was this and Egypt was this?
Yeah. I'm not 100% familiar with all of the different eras of Egypt. You have to bear in mind that the dating that you see in the history books and the dating that we have... The history books are necessarily flawed.
No, I mean us.
No, I'm saying all history, the dating is necessarily flawed. Okay. Because when we say that this is the year 2009, right. It's certainly off.
Right.
Because what are they counting from? Yeah. They're counting from they're counting from an event that when it happened wasn't very significant. The event that they're counting from, when they say 2009 years, from what they're counting from, what the Christian world is counting from, at the time that it happened, was almost meaningless. Very few people cared at that time. It was a couple of 100 years later that people started getting interested in what had happened. I don't even know it was a couple hundred years. It was a long time later that people got interested in what had happened before. And they had to date backwards. And the dating at that time was certainly way off. And so when the calendar, we say it's 2009 years, it is most certainly not 2009 years since that event. There is no question about it.
More or less.
Huh?
more or less?
It is likely less. But I don't know for certain. The Ramban writes this. The Ramban writes this in a debate that he had with the Christians. Talks about this. The dating is for, there's no question that it's off. It would be like today, all of a sudden a religion developed that was solely based on a young farmer boy who lived in the Caribbean sometime in the 1600s, because at that time he grew a tree. He planted a tree. And a religion would develop around that tree. And today, you go back and say, okay, when did that happen? Sometime in the 1600s. Was it the 1600s or was it the 1500s? Maybe it was the 1700s. I don't know. You're working backwards to an event that at the time was meaningless. So the dating is without question off. So when you talk about history books and they're working backwards and they're going to before the Common Era and they're going back then, there's no question the dating is flawed. So you have to just take that with a grain of salt. Whenever you see dating in history books and you try to line them up, there's issues.
Isn't it the fact, though, that, I mean, I hate to get into this subject, but the so-called scriptures of the Christians were written by people of the next generation from his disciples, which means 30, 40 years, 50 years. Oh, boy.
It was beyond that. It didn't become a popular religion until much later. Right? It wasn't, and we're not going to get into the whole, but it didn't become popular until much later. And at that point, anybody could have rewritten anything. It didn't become something which was, things don't stay, you can't date something that people aren't careful to maintain. When people are careful, something is significant. So the Declaration of Independence happened on July 4th, 1776. We are aware of that because when it happened, people knew it was significant, and they cherished it and kept it and documented it. So at the time it was important, and it remained important until today. So that's why we know when it happened. But when something at the time is insignificant, and even though some people may have thought it was significant, it's a very small group of people that considered it significant, people can rewrite and write and do whatever they want. And amend and change, and you don't know, and there's no way to know. And then if a few hundred years later, all of a sudden there's a group of people that say, "Hey, this is something important." Well, there's no real records, or there are no records that are authentic, right?
So is our Torah, Tanakh, are we the only religion claiming that everything was written by Hashem?
Moshe Rabbeinu, and later others instituted an incredible safeguard to our Torah that no other religion can claim to maintain its veracity. And that is called Kriyas HaTorah. The laning, the reading of the Torah every week. Do you know that the rule is, this is a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, this is in the Shulchan Aruch itself. If someone's reading from the Torah in public and makes a mistake, Parshas Miketz. They start off, they read, Vayhi Miketz, it says here in the first pasuk, Vayhi Miketz Shnasayim Yamim, that's what it says, right? So if somebody would read this from the Torah, they would get up and read, Vayhi Miketz Shnasayim Yamim, instead of Miketz. You know what it says to do in Shulchan Aruch?
Correct.
Doesn't say correct him.
Sure.
It says yell at him. Go at him, Bo. It says, you're supposed to say, no, Miketz. You're supposed to yell at him. What kind of a crazy law is that? You're supposed to yell at someone in public and embarrass him? What kind of law is that?
It's not for him. It's for the Kavod HaShem.
It's because it maintains the veracity of the Torah. By having such a law in place, we know that for over 3,000 years, this word has been Miketz. It never said Miketz. It always said Miketz. And we know that. Because anything which is phonetic would have been caught. Because we read from the Torah. And we really read from the Torah every 3 days. And so therefore it would certainly have been caught. anything which is phonetic. Now, if it's not phonetic, it's possible that there a mistake fell in. If there's a yud that's missing, or a vav that's missing, or something like that. Maybe there used to be a yud here. Maybe it was spelled mem yud kuf sadi, which would also sound mikates. That's possible. That's possible. And nobody claims that we have every single non-phonetic consonant. Those could be wrong. But anything phonetic, we are certain we have correctly.
Except that the Shulchan Aruch was written so much later.
Well, the Shulchan Aruch is based on the Gemara. This is not, it didn't make it up.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. So is Judaism the only religion that claims that its holy books are written by Hashem? I mean, because the other religions, and those are just human beings who wrote things down.
Well,
or do they claim that theirs was written by?
Well, I'm not a student of other religions. I assume that they claim that it was divine, that God told whoever to write wrote. Well, we say that also, that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote what Hashem told him to write.
Oh, so they claim that also.
I assume that they claim that. I mean, they couldn't get. Otherwise, it wouldn't be. Huh?
Why did their God actually wait 100 or so years?
No, they would say that it was written down earlier, or was told earlier. You know, the same. But it didn't become. It wasn't something which was. There was no Christian religion, 2009 years ago. There was a person that things happened to that later people said, "Oh, you know, that person is an important person." But there was no, you know, there was a very small sect of people involved with it. Mm-hmm. It only later became. This is as opposed to Islam. Islam had an almost meteoric rise. Once the story with Islam happened, it was almost immediate that it ballooned into this huge religion.
Well, they killed you.
I'm not justifying why or why it didn't happen, but I'm saying with Christianity, it took a long time for it to catch. For it to take hold. Islam took hold very, very quickly. Very quickly.
I think Rabbi Kissin gave a class on that particular era, 2009, and he said that actually in that era, 2009 years ago, that there was a spiritual presence where Mashiach should have come.
Okay, that's what some say, that there was a chance for monotheism in the world, that it was more likely for people to give up paganism.
And because we weren't ready.
But he's not dealing with the amount of years. He's just saying that when that all took place, the world was ready for a change. Right.
Yeah.
Fine. So we therefore have now this dream that Paro has to interpret, needs an interpretation for, and it's not sitting well with him that which the sorcerers and the wise men tell him. And therefore the stage is set for Yosef. And finally, Pasuk Tes verse 9, we have the Sar HaMashkim remembering about Yosef. 2 years after he should have, he finally remembers. And we'll read the verses now, but we're going to have to talk about them next week. Pasuk Tes, Vayidaber Sar HaMashkim es Paro Lemor, the wine steward spoke to Paro saying, Es Chato'ai Ani Mazkir Hayom, my sins I remember today. Paro Katzap Al Avadov, Paro jumped on his servant, which means he got angry at me. Vayiteno Sibe Mishmar, he put me in jail. Beis Sarat Havochim, in the house of the chief butcher. Osib Eis Sar HaOfim, me and the chief baker. And then he's going to go on to say how he dreamed, and Yosef interpreted the dreams. And again, we're going to talk about these verses next week. What I want to leave you with, to think about, is an enigma. An enigma. Why are cows considered to be a sign of plenty or a sign of famine?
Well, because they give milk.
Okay.
They give milk and they give meat.
They give meat. They give meat. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
They used to drink primarily goat's milk, not cow's milk.
That's right.
Yeah. They give meat. Just like sheaves of wheat. You eat them. Didn't the Egyptians worship cows?
Didn't cows also have skins?
They have skins, but you can't slaughter them in Egypt. We're going to have later that the Egyptians would not be willing to eat meat with the Jews because the Jews didn't worship cows, goats, sheep, but the Egyptians did.
I thought it was just sheep. It's not just sheep.
No. Okay, we're going to talk about that, Mirtz Hashem, as we go on.